sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures are at a minor pause here in a rally. I do mean minor. Down 3, NASDAQ futures down 18, Dow futures down 21. Bitcoin tops 100,000 bucks. Immediately somebody says it's going to 200,000. So Greg, if a artificial worthless stock can trade 100,000 bucks, why are we worried about regular stocks getting too high?
Who are you saying, what are you calling worthless?
Well, it's not worthless because you can sell it, but I mean, in terms of what is behind it, nothing.
You know, a lot of child trafficking or sex trafficking and things like laundering.
That's a strong base.
Money laundering. Well, you know, the original crimes.
Yeah, so well, you know, you gotta have
all
that.
The good stuff. There's a market for it. North Korea, extortion, all that kind of stuff.
What was Boris Batinoff, Local 12, Villains, Thieves, and Scoundrels Union?
I mean, there's always going to be a market for crime, and on the internet, that's going to be the currency. So,
do we have Professor Liu before we get too far into this?
Well, not a professor, but good morning.
You've taught classes. You can be a professor.
No, I'm not. I'm not woke enough.
You're not woke at all.
I dare say that there's no school in the country that would hire me for anything, especially after some of the discussions we've had on this show.
Well, I'd say that most of the discussions on this show are kind of in the middle of all this stuff. We have a few guys that skewer that are right a tad, but most of the stuff here is I think both sides could take a look at and say that makes a little sense, because most of the time we have some facts to back up what we say, and you know what they say, never let the facts get in the middle of a good story, Lou.
So I'm gonna give you a good story. It has salacious details, and it involves sports and law.
There you go.
So the Mountain West Conference, which is where my alma mater plays and is predominantly comprised, in fact, it may be exclusively comprised of state schools, is in the throes of two very high profile pieces of litigation right now. The one that has the salacious details involves a transgender volleyball player. In this case, and of course these cases always go in one direction, it's a guy who says he's a woman and is playing on the women's volleyball team at a place called San Jose State.
Is he fixed or just feeling that way?
No, he's not fixed. He's identified.
Okay.
So this.
What?
Say again.
Fixed? Calling him broken?
Are his parts removed?
He's fixed it. He's fixed in the sense that whatever, and I'm going to sound callous here, but whatever mental illness these people are suffering from, it causes them to believe that they're. Biological equipment is the wrong type. And so in extreme cases, and this is the case that got argued at the Supreme Court yesterday, in extreme cases they demand surgery, and everything I've read about the surgery sounds like it's just a kind of ritualized setting yourself up for torture for the rest of your life. But anyway, this guy didn't do this. This person did not go through that. He is playing with all the equipment, which of course means that he's basically a biological male with all the genetic advantages of that status, playing against a bunch of women.
Was he taking, not that we know, but is he taking the pills that's estrogen instead of testosterone?
I'm not clear on that, but it doesn't matter because he's already been through puberty as a male, right. So he's got all the biological advantages of that testosterone surge that we get when we go through puberty. And if you watch him play, you know, he's jumping 6 to 8 inches higher than the rest of the women. He's hitting the ball at, you know, 70 miles an hour at people's faces.
You know, if I did that, you wouldn't notice because I couldn't jump at all.
Well, yeah. So this guy can, he's out playing. Well, so over the course of the season, a number of volleyball teams, so like four college teams refused to play him. And the Mountain West had a rule in place that said, look, you sort out how you want to deal with the trans issue. We're not trans, you know, biological men playing on women's teams. Like I said, it always goes in one direction. I'm unaware of a biological woman who has made any kind of case for playing on a men's team because things don't work in that direction. And they're, you know, unless you're playing darts or something. So the Mountain West has a rule that says if you're going to do this, do it however you want. But if the other side says we're not playing against a team with a guy on it, because it's dangerous or it's unfair, then that's a default and it counts as a loss.
Really?
So four teams defaulted and lost to San Jose State over the course of the season, and then they get into the tournament. So just before the tournament starts, several players from other schools, along with an assistant coach at San Jose State, who was objecting to having this man play with the women, and there's a bunch of other stuff regarding how San Jose State has handled it. So, for example, when these women came, you know, to the school, they didn't tell them that this guy was a guy. They allowed this male player to pick his own female roommate when they go on the road.
Did she know in advance?
No. They found out about it. She found out this one of the women players that was protesting and at San Jose State, and this assistant volleyball coach didn't realize what was going on until later. So in any event, they go into federal court here in Denver and try to get an injunction to stop this guy from playing or disqualify San Jose State. The court basically says you waited too late to do this. You've known about this for months. It's not an emergency. We're not going to give you the injunction. So San Jose State goes into the tournament. They win, I think, their first game. The second game in semifinals, the team that's playing them defaults and says, we're not doing this. You know, we're not gonna play against a team with a man on it. It's unfair and it's unsafe. So this puts them into the finals against Colorado State. If San Jose State wins in the finals, and this all happened last weekend, if they win, then they go to the NC2A tournament as an automatic bid. And that would have created a nightmare for the NC2A because they would have now had to confront the fact that they've got a man playing, you know, it was the functional equivalent of what happened with Leah Thomas, the Penn swimmer who was a guy swimming against women. And the NC2A would have been a real pickle because they don't have a clear policy on this. Again, they're leaving it up to the schools, and you put this team into the tournament with a man playing on it, and you know, you're gonna have people default, you're gonna have other legal issues arise. Fortunately, Colorado State University won the match, and so they're going into the NC2As. But the lawsuit, you know, goes on because it involves claims under Title IX and some other discrimination claims, in addition to a First Amendment claim, because San Jose State and they're accusing the Mountain West and San Jose State of suppressing the speech of these people. Now, San Jose State clearly has done this with their complaining volleyball coach. They've suspended her for indefinitely and done some other stuff.
What did she do?
she complained that there was a man playing on her team, and she started raising questions about why are we doing this and how are we doing it.
I guess I missed the whole thing. There's, let's say, for instance, I'm back in college, and not that I was good enough even to play in probably some of the girls' teams, but all of a sudden there's a girls' softball team, and I walk out and I go, here I am. Why would they even give me a mitt, for God's sake?
Well, because in California, they're required to. And the Biden administration's Title IX regulations require you to. They require you to treat gender as flexible. And so a
what if somebody walks out with nine guys for the softball team?
Tom, this is one of the reasons why Harris lost. Is
that I would agree with that, yeah.
This crazy, absolutely crazy element within and it's exclusively a Democrat Party issue within the Democrat Party has gone off the rails on this issue of men participating against women.
Why don't the I was talking to actually one of my best friends, a guy you would love to sit with and talk to, Lou, a guy who's been a criminal attorney for pushing 60 years. Stories about every guy that ever in Chicago, right? And he's a Democrat his whole life, sort of like I was, although not anymore. I mean, I can't say that either party tickles me too much. And he said, you know, I don't understand how come, you know, everybody voted for this guy. And I said, Bill, they didn't vote for him. They voted against a lot of this stuff. Nobody understands why everybody's broke. I mean, even though everybody all day long tells you how rich you are because the market's up, a lot of people are broke, not everybody. And I said, we have somebody talking about how she's going to spend her life worrying about people in jail getting sex change operations. I mean, nobody wants that. And nobody wants their daughters playing with guys, and nobody in business wants to put in a third bathroom at their expense. It makes zero sense. The party has got to get off that because it's just going nowhere.
Well, it's so you're seeing a really interesting collision, much like the Masterpiece Cake case out here in Colorado. You're seeing a really interesting collision between basic constitutional rights and equal protection. So you run into a problem with, for example, a transgender employee who is male but wants to be called a man or a woman. So the guy, you know, he dresses in dresses, he puts on makeup, he grows his hair, and there, if you don't refer to him as she or, you know, the right pronoun, or you say, look, I'll call you whatever you want to be called, but, you know, I'm not going to treat you like you're a woman. That's a Title VII violation. If you don't, you know, if you're not coerced into ignoring reality on this, you know, this is one of these things that the Supreme Court's going to have to wrestle with it. The federal judge that handled the case here, you know, got the right answer because of the delay in filing the law, the 6-month delay in filing the request for an injunction. But then he went off the rails and, you know, ran along a line of reasoning saying, well, you know, if transgender, you're discriminating against somebody who's transgender if you're not letting them on the volleyball court, and that's a discrimination based on sex, and that's, you know, as we know from Bostock, and that's the Supreme Court case that opened the door to all this. Bostock says, in employment, you can't discriminate on this basis, and that creates a huge problem because, as I said, these very small group of people are basically requiring you to deny reality, and the explosion of these trans issues is this denial of reality, or alternatively, you know, you've got to play along with the, again, mentally ill perspective of an individual who says, irrespective of what I actually am, you've got to call me this.
Well, did we ever watch your Boston Legal?
I mean, I know the show.
It would. I thought it was one of the best shows I ever saw on TV. But it was kind of weird. It had, you know, William Shatner is the guy who's going kind of goofy. So that was, even though it wasn't funny because he was losing his marbles a little bit. Put a little bit of comedy in the show, and they always had the best looking women. Not that I noticed. But every show they'd also have a real serious sort of legal sort of thing.
The episodes I watched made me tear my hair out because it really wasn't about law.
Well, no, it wasn't. But there was one I remember where there was a lady who had a small firm, and I don't know what the hell they did, but she hires this guy who's one of those what was L. Ron Hubbard's group? What was it?
Oh, a Scientologist.
Yes, he was a Scientologist, and this guy comes into the firm, and evidently didn't tell anybody, but now he's. You know, she's got a five-person firm, and I don't know if it was something serious, a consulting firm, a law firm, or something. And all the guy did was espouse this to like the clients and stuff, to the point where he was, you know, turning people off. And then they got to the thing where, you know, you can't fire somebody based on their religion, obviously. So James Spader went in front of the judge and he gave this really, really eloquent thing, and he said, you know, when you start pushing things to this much of an envelope, where you really start ruining somebody's business or ruining the people around you. We're not designed to do that. I mean, this guy can be whatever he wants, but he can't be broadcasting this and berating people for being in other religions on somebody else's property and their dime. I'm not doing any justice to James Spader. It's pretty eloquent, but this stuff reaches the point where if you want to do something, knock yourself out. If somebody thinks they're a lady or a guy or whatever, even though they were born the other way, I mean, I guess that could happen. With some kind of hormonal thing or something, but the idea that all of a sudden everybody else has to somehow cave in your way and make things hard for everybody else—I don't even know if you get the right to do that necessarily.
Well, so this is the battle, and Greg will probably recognize this term, and it's you want to bring your whole self to work. Are you familiar with that, Tom?
No, actually.
Okay, Greg.
Yeah, I've heard it.
Yeah. So this relates to a concept, and it's part of the activist agenda. I say agenda. Activist schooling that a lot of people are getting in college, which is, you know, the idea is we're going to make all of our graduates activists for social justice and good change. And that means you have to bring this kind of a spirit to everywhere you go, including your employment. And so bringing your whole self to work involves, you know, your expression of your personal goals and feelings about, and it's very feeling driven, personal feelings about politics, religion, whatever, and express that at work. And so this kind of thing immediately leads to division. It's designed to lead to division, but it leads immediately to division in any kind of workplace because people have different opinions. And because people who believe that they should be bringing their whole self to work come in with the idea that this is a moral, you know, issue, and these are more, you know, there's a moral righteousness that attaches to their position, they get offended real fast. And when they get offended, they look around for legal redress. And so this pushes all of these issues right into my sphere. It's one of the reasons why I'm never going to lack for work, because in the employment sphere, this kind of issue where you have so the Spader issue you just tossed out there is actually a very easy one from a legal perspective. You are not allowed under any of our employment discrimination codes to take positions that are problematic for your business after a certain point. But again, under the guidance from the EEOC, let's say you have a technician who's, you know, 6'3", you know, 210, great, you know, big physical condition, because a guy. And he's decided he's developed gender dysphoria as a man in his late 20s. So he puts on lipstick, he grows his hair out, he wears the female version of the uniforms. He's probably taking estrogen. And this guy's a traveling technician, so he shows up at somebody's house to fix a doorbell or a garage door opener. This has happened, and I mean, when it happened to me, when it happened to us, I mean, my wife said, "Well, when you get home, this guy's going to be working on our stuff. Don't get crazy." And it's this technician, you know, again, an obvious male, dressed like a woman, acting, you know, wanting to be called Charlotte or whatever, and so that would be off-putting. I mean it was off-putting to me, not to the extent that I was going to say, you know, get out of the house, but it was off-putting, and you can imagine it being off-putting to a lot of people to have somebody come in who's obviously off in that way. And does that affect your business? Yes. Does it create headaches for you as an employer? Yes. Not just with in terms of your client contact. Well,
some people wouldn't care if the guy didn't make a deal out of it. He showed up their house.
Well, that's right. That's
I wouldn't care.
That's,
wouldn't bother
that's,
me.
Well, that's part of the game. But you maybe you wouldn't. But the immediate reaction of a lot of people is, this guy is off. You know, there's something wrong with him. Why is this person having customer contact with me? So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, what if this guy wants to use the women's bathroom at work? I mean, I work out at a gym here in Denver that's got at least two men who are, quote, identifying as women and who are in the women's locker room every time.
Yeah,
I see them go to the women's locker room every time.
I don't know if there's a common sense. I mean, I'm Catholic, or I was raised Catholic. I'm not big on the not meat on Friday part, a little bit of, but if all of a sudden, you know, the company was going to have a, and I was working for some big place, and there were 15 Catholics there, and they're going to have a huge pizza party on Friday, I might say, gee, you know, a bunch of people here don't eat meat. How about getting a couple of cheese pizzas? I think you could go that far. I don't think you could say you can't bring meat into the building.
That's a whole different issue, because that request doesn't collide with anybody else's rights.
That's what I'm saying. But nobody can have a sausage pizza. Well, that's a little too far, in my opinion.
Yeah. So this is the functional equivalent of what is happening in workplaces and gyms and locker rooms and bathrooms around the country.
I think the house issue, though, that kind of wanders into a different spot in my mind.
It does.
Because there it's a question of, is the person doing anything wrong? Are they trying to talk you or your wife into turning one way or the other? Are they just doing the job and they're just being themselves? But now the question is, if you're, you know, Lou Michaels electricians, do you want that person representing you?
Exactly.
That's the problem, you know?
Yeah, and it creates issues. And so people can say, well, you should be more broad-minded and more accepting. I understand that argument. The short answer is, if I'm inviting somebody into my home, can I at least get somebody who's not manifesting signs of a mental issue?
But it may turn out they do a good enough job where you ask for them next time, no matter what.
this guy did fine work, and I talked to him. I talked to him on two or three, you know, occasions for 5 minutes or so. So I wasn't interrupting what he was doing because he had another job to get to. But I just thought, you know, We're polite, and so we're not going to say, look, I don't want you in my house. But if I had kids, small children in the house, who are going to be kind of, what the heck is going on here? It might be a different story. Or if I lived by myself, and I was a woman, and this guy comes in who's obviously got these issues, am I going to feel safe with that? Should my feelings of safety trump his feelings of, I want to dress like a woman and be called a woman's name?
Well, you can't assume everybody else has, you know, the same live and let live view that you do. And it's unfortunate,
correct.
But people, you know, then again, there's people that are so closed-minded that, you know, you can't even go there. Let's go to a quick break here, but SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down 14. Again, Bitcoin over 100,000. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Good luck with your layoffs, all right? I hope your firings go really well. Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 275. NASDAQ futures down 1350. This again, if we hit record highs yesterday and just about everywhere. We're going a percent and a half a day in some of these big stocks. I mean, it's really amazing the attitude on the new administration. Everything that was ever wrong with the world is going to get fixed by this guy, but I don't know. Numbers still seem to add up for me, but maybe they don't for some. DAX up 74.4%. FTSE down 3%. Call that flat. Tech around up 15.2%, so slightly up, but not much over in Europe. Asia's been kind of on fire. Nikkei's up another 119 today, 0.3%, 39,395. Obviously trying to make a drive towards 40,000. Hang Seng down 182, that's a full percent, 19,560. Just can't quite make it to that 20,000 number. Shanghai up 4, call that flat, 33,68. Yesterday, again, we're up 308 in the Dow. I think Dow's at a new record. It closed over 45,000. When I came into business, it was 800, Lou, 800. S&P futures up 36, 6,086. NASDAQ up 254, 19,735 is every day two or three of the seven stocks that are down kissing the mistletoe in Mar-a-Lago is up 2 or 3%. Every one of those guys just can't stop them. Russell was up 10 points, 0.4%. Bonds up 4 basis points, 4.22. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.08. Japan up 2 base points, 1.07. So they're a long way from that 1%. Now oil up 2 cents, but still 68.56. Can't get out of these high 60s. We had a print over 70 the other day, I think, Greg, but it came right back down again. Brent up 7 cents, 72.38. Natural gas up 5 cents, 309. It's pretty cold outside. RBOB unchanged, 193. Gold down 320, but still high 2,600, 26.73. Silver down 9 cents, 31.82. Copper down, unchanged at 419. Foreign exchange, the pound still 105. It's back over 105, not the pound, the euro. It ducked under 105, so it's gotten a little stronger. The pound is at 127, so the dollar is weakened just a little bit, but not that much. Crypto, this is a big story, though, up 4,000, 102.886, not just over 100,000, but blew through it like dinner through a goose, for God's sake. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Good morning, everyone. It is 6:34 here in Chicago. Windy and cold. The note says wear layers today. It feels like 12 right now. High of 29 today. Phoenix, 51 degrees right now. Mostly sunny, very warm. High of 79 there. Traffic, we've got inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 28 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 44 minutes. Inbound Ike from Wolf is 28 minutes. The inbound Ryan from 95th, 18 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 25 minutes. Hockey. Bruins beat the Hawks. That was at the UC. That was 4-2. And tonight we have Packers at Lions. And Detroit is favored by 3.5. It should be a good game. That's all I got, Chief.
So you think if Lou is doing the walk-in like he used to, come in the studio and was walking across the bridge over the river, he'd be sniveling about the wind and the cold this morning?
It feels exactly like it says. It feels 12 right now, and the wind is not helping.
It was a 50-mile-an-hour gust yesterday. That might have flipped your ass in the river, the 50-mile-an-hour gust.
Yikes.
That's a cold wind. I don't know if I would have been sniveling, because it's not that far a walk from the train station to the studio, but a good walk across the loop, which is what I used to do regularly, I'd have been. There were a couple of days there where, we had like 10 below zero when I set out from my house, and those were cold walks.
Now we're comfortably into the hat and gloves weather.
Yes. Very much so.
If you don't have those, you've got about, 5 minutes outside, and then it gets pretty
I didn't see you would have this morning.
Nope, I actually didn't bring one, which is why I said that.
You know, a hat is a day-long commitment if you have any kind of decent hair.
I would make that trade this morning, that's for sure.
Yeah. Hey, so Lou, I was listening to...
Oh, by the way, have you noticed... Yeah, did you guys talk at all about the execution of that United Health CEO?
We caught it for a second, but I want to talk to you about that. I was talking about something else first, but let's do that one first. What is the deal there? My attorney buddy last night says, first thing you think of, it's got to be, is there a lady involved or something involved? But they haven't seen anything like that in a long time. But if you got a lady involved, normally that guy looked like he was a professional hitman. He looked like a jackal, for God's sake.
Well, he certainly, my take, having watched the video, my take is that this was somebody who, if he wasn't a quote hitman unquote, was certainly somebody who knew what he was doing with respect to the guns. So he's firing a gun with what looks to like a suppressor on the end of it, a quote silencer.
That was my question. Did he have a silencer on there? It looked like it did.
Yeah. He had a suppressor. He definitely had a suppressor on there. The other thing that's interesting is he's racking the slide on the handgun. So it's a semi-auto. He's racking the slide on the handgun each time after he shoots. Now, the two reasons, explanations for that. One, the gun is malfunctioning. Or two, he's using ammunition that is not sufficiently powerful to pull the slide all the way back to clear the round. And this, the way he was doing it indicated to me that it was not a malfunction. He expected it to do this, which means he was firing probably something like subsonic ammunition. So subsonic ammunition, as the name implies, pushes the bullet out much more slowly, and it doesn't give you the same kind of recoil necessary to push the slide back on a semi-automatic pistol. So he's firing, and the reason you use subsonic ammunition is because one of the big sources of sound when you fire a gun is the bullet breaking the sound barrier as it exits the barrel. So when you use subsonic ammunition, you're already shooting a quieter bullet, and he put the suppressor in there.
Did you see? I don't know if it's true, but they were saying that there were messages on the bullets too.
There were words.
Yeah, three delay, words, defend.
Defend, deny. Depose. Yeah, deny, defend, depose, scratched onto the bullet casings.
Is that real or is that just...
I saw the report too. I haven't seen it confirmed.
Yeah.
But that, you know, who knows what that means? I don't know if you remember your Sherlock Holmes, but A Study in Scarlet, which was the first Sherlock Holmes novel, has the killer writing the words "Raish" R-A-C-H-E, in blood on the wall of the room where he's killed this guy, and it was put up there. They were looking for somebody named Rachel, but Raish is the German word for revenge, and so they were running off on a false lead, and Holmes was, you know, looking at that going, this was put up there just to throw off the police. So you never know with something like that. Somebody doing that might have done that to try to divert the cops from looking at what, you know, Tom, was my first thought too, that this was some kind of hit or this was some kind of murder based on something like a woman or a gambling debt or something like that. You could scratch something on the bullet to make people think, well, it was more likely a disgruntled.
This guy's way insured. More professional than just your normal ex-boyfriend or husband.
That's right. So he could have been hired by an ex-boyfriend.
Where do you go get a professional at that man? It's like hiring a jackal, for God's sake.
You can use Bitcoin.
Well, that,
that's right. You use Bitcoin. So this is you know, totally bizarre. And of course, the other interesting point about this, he shot him in close range, which is what you have to do with ammunition like that. He didn't shoot him in the head. He shot him in the chest and in the leg. So I was sort of surprised at that, because if it's an assassination, I mean, if it's you know, one of the intelligence agencies, you know, you get the guy down and then you shoot him in the head to make sure you kill him. But who knows? It's a horrible thing, but it's from a firearms perspective. Watching him rack the slide, I was thinking, okay, the first time he did it, I thought, oh, he had a malfunction. But then he did it again, and again, it wasn't like he was looking at the gun trying to figure out where it had misfired, which is what you do with a malfunction. You clear it, you drop the magazine on a semi-auto, and you clear the slide. He didn't drop the magazine. This was something he was prepared for and something he expected. So that tells me that the ammunition was you know, likely subsonic.
Well, he raced down the
shot spotter. The idea is maybe shot spotter wouldn't pick it up.
Well, he raced down the alley, jumped on, was it one of those little motorized bikes?
Yes, City Electric bike. So he had to reserve that bike with something.
Well, now, but if you fire off on that bike into the park, you're lost. I mean, I've been in the park. People can find you in there. I used to run in the park when I was in New York, when I was younger, and run around there.
I'm
not so sure they couldn't find you in there.
Well, I don't know what the cameras are. You know, it's surveillance that allows you to track him. And so I don't know whether they've got cameras covering the entire of Central Park. I suspect if he planned it to this extent, he planned his getaway so that there was a covered place where he could ditch the bike, pull off his hoodie, drop the mask, maybe take off his pants. It might have been sweatpants, and he's got regular pants on underneath, and ditch that, and then walk out looking like a, you know, just somebody walking for a stroll in Central Park at 6:45.
Well, for those that have never been there, and I've been there a long time, but I suspect they still do it. A couple of in the afternoons, maybe in the, and I've been in the morning too. A couple of the roads through Central Park are closed to any kind of vehicular traffic. They're all for just bikers and joggers and walkers. So I mean, if you could get in there with one of these bikes and ditch it, and all of a sudden run out in your jogging pants and a hoodie, I think you just jog away and nobody knows where the hell you were.
Yeah. So this was not an unplanned thing. I suspect that he probably used either a stolen or a phony credit card to reserve the bike, and they'll find a dead end there. If they were able to recover the actual bullets versus the casings, they may be able to try to get a match on a gun if they ever find the gun. But I'm guessing the gun has been broken up into several pieces and pitched into a sewer somewhere.
Well, I mean, is it? If I Googled assassin for hire, would anybody come up?
On the dark web, yes. Not on Google.
But on the dark web, you have to know people's address to get to them, right?
Stop talking about this.
Yeah, we're gonna trigger. I'm just looking out my window right now to see if I've got black sedans pulling up in front of my house.
God, well, I mean, we're not the only people who said if this was a hitman, where the hell do you find him?
Yeah,
we're not the only people thinking that.
I'm going to start censoring you, Tom.
Well, do you think I'm the only person in this country who thinks that if the guy was hired, how does somebody find somebody like that? I mean,
that is subject another show. Thank you.
There are at least two or three cases I can think of where guys killed their wives, and one of the things that they got them on was they were on Google searching for, you know, how do I find an assassin or a hitman?
Really? Well, but those guys must have got in there and got their computer or something.
Well, they didn't even need to do that. They just searched their Google accounts. They didn't even need to get to the computer. They could track it through the Google account. You know, there's a couple of those cases where the defendant got on Google. How do I dispose of a dead body? How long does it take acid to dissolve? You know, dissolve somebody.
People are so bizarre, you know, aren't they?
What's the easiest way to dismember, you know, a body and bury the parts? I mean,
remember when they first came out with those running shoes that had the little lights in the bottom of them so people could see you?
Yes.
One of my policeman buddies told me These two guys showed up in did an armed robbery at this place and disappeared off into the woods with those little lights on their shoes. How easy they were to track. You know, people do some of the darndest things.
Well, nobody really thinks about, you know, and that's why this thing looks professional, looks like a hit piece. The move of this guy, and like I said, the way he was handling the gun, very, very interesting.
Well, so, I guess a stupid question. I want to ask you a little bit about what's going on with some of the government stuff. I think I know that having a silencer, a suppressor, whatever you want to call them, is illegal.
It's not illegal. You just have to go through an application process.
So you can actually have
sure. Guys I shoot with have them. I mean, they're very useful. If you're going to be out shooting, you know, 500, 600 rounds on a day at the range, you know, you put ear protection in, but this thing also, it helps with ear protection dramatically.
Okay, but now does every gun have the threads where you can just screw the thing on?
No, but there are adapters that you can buy to attach them to a normal pistol.
You know what's so interesting about this, the timing of this, is evidently the whole world is glued to this, I don't have Prime Plus, whatever the hell it is glued to the remake of The Day of the Jackal. I don't know if you know that or not, but it's
well, is there a recent remake? Because they remade it with Bruce Willis. How long ago?
No, this is some kind of a mini series, and it's on, like, I don't know, Bill Murphy told me it was on like hour six or something. Him and his wife were glued to it. I remember the
that
first
was a great book.
It was a great movie.
Frederick Forsyth, right?
Yeah. But it was one of the first movie was, you know, followed the book word for word.
I mean, yes.
Of course, in this world we have now, the detective that they dug out to find him, because they knew they had a real problem, they got their best detective. He's this kind of dumpy-looking guy, French guy, and he goes, if I'm going to take the job, nobody can bother me. Here's my budget. You got to get me two cats in my office, one for me and one for my assistant, because, by the way, we're not going anywhere. That's all we're going to do 24/7 is chase this guy. And he's this kind of dumpy, you know, white guy with glasses. Well, now, of course, the person chasing him is a black lady, right? You got to roll that, even though, you know, which, you know, doesn't mean there aren't black lady detectives that are pretty darn good. But, of course, you got to change that, right, for the modern world. But I thought in the book and in the movie, the scene where he went to the gun designer and designed the assassin's rifle.
Yes.
I thought that was absolutely special. And then what was the guy's thought process? The guy who made the gun goes, it's so rewarding to deal with a true professional.
Jesus.
Yeah. As he made this incredible assassin's rifle that fits in a crutch, right? Where the pad on the crutch was the pad on the gun.
Yep.
Ugh.
And so, yeah, that and but the problem was it only fired one shot, and you had to, you know, re-crank it and open up the bolt and everything else to get another round in there. And that's so when they find him, you know, he's able to kill the first guy that comes in the door, but he can't get reloaded fast enough.
But he also missed De Gaulle.
Right. Much like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
De Gaulle just happens to turn his head and bend down slightly, and the bullet misses him. And I've thought about that assassination attempt on Trump last summer. You know, where would we be right now without that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or if that had succeeded, it's terrifying to think about.
Oh, it's. I think it probably ended up helping him vote wise, but still, you don't want to go through that. You don't want to dodge a bullet for votes, I don't think.
No, and I mean, and you'll never convince me that a significant, you know, portion of the people on the other side of this thing who had been demonizing him for, you know, for months at that point weren't really sort of secretly hoping that that would happen.
Oh, I, as you know, on a personal level, I can't stand the man, but I would never want that on anybody, for God's sake.
Well, no, you wouldn't, but if you have a bunch of people, you know, 24/7, I've got friends who believe this, you know.
Plus, I think there's a chance
he's Hitler, and this is going to be the end of our democracy. This will be the last election we have. You know, I mean, if you get a bunch of people screaming that 24/7, a certain percentage of the population is going to believe you. Some of them very well educated.
I would. Well, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you about the academy here, but we got some time. You know, I mean, I got some, you know, some people on the show to give me. I never compared the man, and never would, to Hitler. I don't think Trump's capable of killing anybody. He has a different personality than I necessarily like, but the campaign, the way you find stuff, the way you attract people, the playbook has always been sort of the same. When people are in trouble, you put people to blame out there. You lob stuff out there that isn't necessarily true that people are going to believe. There's always somebody that you put blame on. I mean, in this case, it was the migrant workers. It absolutely exaggerated every. You know, nobody wants the migrant situation. Nobody wants people swimming across the river. Nobody wants that. Exaggerations were absolutely dramatic, because people are economically hurting, they're going to believe this stuff. Even if you know, there's still people believing that people are eating cats and dogs in Ohio, even Trump said it wasn't true. But that's just the way it works. But both sides, everybody does that. I mean, you try and get people to
believe. You don't say it's one thing to say, look, immigration is creating huge economic problems for us, and it's costing us jobs, and it's costing us wages, and a bunch of stuff like that. Versus, this guy is going to be the end of our democracy as we know it if you elect him.
Well,
that's a completely different kind.
There's a lot of people, Lou, that think, and I kind of want to get off this topic, but that think that somehow the person who leads your place needs to be, you know, purer than Pharaoh's wife because it reflects on other people. And the man isn't. I mean, you know, I question why a lot of women can vote for him. I mean, the guy's never saw an ass he didn't want to grab, I mean, when he was younger. I mean, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have a skill set. We've had a lot of presidents that were pretty awful people. And, you know, and maybe he's changed. I think he's learned a hell of a lot since the first time he was in there. And I'm actually expecting him to do some good, to be honest with you. And by the way, he's my president. If he called tomorrow and wanted some help, I'd be the first one to say yes. Right? I mean, but it doesn't mean that I forgive him for not paying all the people he used to not pay and all those kinds of things and all the people he took to court that he had no right. I mean, he's not my kind of businessman. Let's put it that way. But now he's a president. I hope that skill set does us some good. And it might. Yeah. And it might.
And in any event, what did you want
to
talk about?
Well, I'm saying I was listening to. It's funny how some of the things that we talk about on Stocks and Jacks. We had Katie, I think Rather's her last name. She was on. I hope to have her again because she's back in town. The lady who was doing all the research at some of the hospitals. Remember that she was doing. She was at Northwestern, and then she'd give the presentations at Harvard and at Sloan, I think. Anyway, very bright, very nice young lady. And so she was at Vanderbilt, and I was asking her about if somebody puts money into, you know, a disease, for lack of a better term, or somebody raises money and, you know, how much, and she brought it up. I didn't even ask, so I can't pat myself on the back. She said something about, well, you know, the hospitals put this big overhead on anything you give them. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't really think of that, I suppose, but so because I was more on the theme of how does Pfizer come out of these places? You know, Lou Michaels might give, or you know, your dad died a while ago. Your dad might give, you know, leave $1 million to the University of Tennessee Medical Center or something. He might just leave a general chunk of change like that to them. Okay, now you might. No, you're not dead, and hopefully not for a really, really long time. You might say, oh, no, there's a certain disease that I know a friend whose daughter or son or somebody has this disease, and they're doing research on it at the University of Tennessee or someplace. I'm gonna throw those guys $40,000 for that disease sort of thing, or research for that disease, for research on it. She basically said, way expanded my mind, which is easy to do, and how many different ways money comes into these things. Then there's people who are, it might be a doctor, Dr. Greg Pappas, that said, I'm going to do some research on, you know, some orphan disease that only affects Greek guys or something. And you might go to the Washington and you might actually score a, you know, some research money for that. And that goes in. There's all kinds of different ways that money is entering the system. But she brought up the the point that the research centers, these hospitals, throw a big overhead on top of this. And I was more looking at, all of a sudden, if Tennessee or wherever Greg gave his money or you, if all of a sudden some miracle drug comes flying out of there, how does Pfizer end up, or somebody like that, with the patent on the thing for 20 years, where they're gouging the hell out of people, and you were the guys or the people who worked on it, did all the work and put up all the money, and you don't get squat? And, I mean, I was wondering how the hell that all works. And of course, you didn't have all those answers, but I don't know if you listen to how do you pronounce the guy's name that's with Musk on this deal where they're gonna cut some of the fat in government?
Vivek Ramsey.
Yeah,
Ramsey is his name.
But listen to him yesterday, I'll tell you what, the guy sounded. Now, my question is, I'll tell you what the base of it first. He said, you know, these hospitals put a 70% overhead on this stuff. Like if we give money to $1 million to same place I'm talking about, to an orphan thing somewhere at some hospital, the hospital grabs like 70% of it for overhead. He goes, nobody. Matter of fact, we had a listener gave the lady from Fisher House $1,000 out of their foundation. And they researched it, Diane's been on the air, Diane Kelly, and that's the place, it's like the Ronald McDonald House for Veterans. And they researched it, like Diane said, that like 5% of the dough is taking it over, the rest of it goes right to the people. So, like Rapsa Swami said yesterday, nobody would give money to a place that took 70% of the dough. Why is the government doing it? I mean, and he's absolutely correct. But now my question, Lou, is long story short, don't tell it, is what happens if he cuts that, or they cut that, or the government cuts that down to 30%, which you and I might say, boy, that's a much better number, duh. What happens to these colossus, massive cities at the University of Chicago and Rush and Northwestern, these massive behemoths that hire all these people every month? Carl Coe's talking about that almost all of the increase in employment, not almost all, but a real lot of increased employment is pouring into this medical sector, all these overhead areas and research and all this crap. They're not. Most of them aren't serving any purpose for you and I going in with a hangnail. That's not what they're doing. But so if government cuts back on all that, what happens to all that hiring? What happens to all these? You know, the CEOs there aren't going to cut their salary. What happens to the city that has become Northwestern? Or, you know, that just is this massive sucking sound of money. I mean, it's not like it won't have a repercussion. It sounds great that the government's not going to pay it, okay, unless you cut your overhead. But if we cut the overhead, I'm not saying they shouldn't get laid off, but all this stuff has a cost, Lou. I mean, I think when people start, they don't understand the definition of economics. Economics is the apportionment of scarcity. That's what it does. And how many people even know that? I mean, if everybody could go to the replicator, like on the Enterprise, and order chicken soup, you wouldn't need economics, right? Because everybody has everything. So what?
Well, that was the Gene Roddenberry fiction. Let me start with some elements. First of all, the way that Pfizer gets the rights to this, or a portion of the rights to it, is that they put in money to support the research.
Maybe.
It's not maybe. You're an economics guy. They buy that.
I think they buy the drug. They buy the rights to the drug with these people too.
Well, but they're not stealing it. They put money in somewhere usually it's on the research side. So they'll put money in. They will use the research facilities and they may guide it, they may direct it some, but they are basically using those research facilities. The people working at the research facilities are working there for an employer. The employer owns the patent rights and the rights to the intellectual property. Whoever that is, whether it's the university, whether it's Pfizer, whomever. If you're doing this with a company's resources, you know, you're being paid for your brain power. And the company says, fine, we're gonna pay you X for this. Now they may give you an incentive based on a success fee or something like that, but you know, the short answer is, you know, it's the law of the shop. The employer owns what the employee produces.
But it gets a little wobblier than that. Sorry, Robbie, it's wobbly because sometimes the guys get their own money, and sometimes you give money right to the guy or for the disease.
Well, sometimes, yeah. And like I said, that could be a separate That could be a separate arrangement. There may be a success fee attached to it. But the short answer is the university providing these facilities and you know, it's the other investors who are putting the money in to support the investment or support the research, they own the product. And so it's not a huge leap for the licensing rights and everything else that flows out of that. That goes back to that company.
Well, I wouldn't care so much if it didn't give somebody the right to gouge for 17 years, because the patent's supposed to be the person who invents it, right?
Well, but the person who invents it's doing the work as part of their job. So they're being economically compensated for that. So you know, a lot of these places will put incentive fees and incentive arrangements.
It's not that.
That's number one.
It's a little murkier number than two, that. It's a little murkier than that.
Yeah, no, it's not murkier than that. Once you get in, if you look at the contracts, it all gets pretty clear. Now, who's entitled to what? And in some cases, it falls apart, and that's when you get a lawsuit. But no, this stuff is all, trust me, having looked at the contracts for, you know, vaccines over the last few years, I can tell you that they're convoluted, but you can figure out who's getting what for how much. And everybody has the understanding on that when they, you know, when those agreements are signed and things move forward. With respect to the jobs that are being supported by this and the overhead, you know, the short answer there is OPM, other people's money.
Yeah.
As long as you're spending other people's money, you don't have any incentive to cut the bloat. One of the things that's going to happen right out of the gate, I suspect, is the Trump people are going to come in and say, look, we're not supporting any more DEI infrastructure. So a lot of these facilities have DEI overseers on the labs and on the university side especially. And you know, the Trump comes in and says, fine, you want an NIH grant? None of that money can go to DEI. You can fund that yourself. And so that's going to result in a number of those positions going away. I expect that to happen.
That's not where the lion's share of the money is. The lion's share of the money is going to the management class that makes a gazillion dollars and didn't know how to treat it.
Wait a minute. How much do you think the DEI supervisor at a DEI VP at a place like the University of Michigan earns?
I'm sure they do pretty well.
Like $500,000 a year. And her staff are all in six figures. If you look at the numbers on this, if you look at the
I think you could cut the entire top floor, not just that person.
Well, you eliminate all of it, and you know you're starting to talk about some serious money. That's the first thing, and that's one of the easiest things to cut, I think. And then because it contributes absolutely nothing to the product.
I'm talking about this.
There'll be other layers of overhead, and I mean again, if this DOGE team works, they're going to come in and say, we're not funding this. This is what Musk did at Twitter. Why do I have 15 mid-level managers here?
Yeah, you can't. That's the thing that's kind of frosted me here. We got a dash, but that's the thing that's kind of frosted me here. Everybody, I didn't think you would do, everybody is looking at the, in Trumpy we trusty. Everything that's going to be cut is a thing they want to be cut. That's not going to happen. Everybody's convinced that whatever these guys are going to do, first of all, they're going to be miracle workers, and that whatever they decide to cut is exactly what you think they should cut. That's not going to happen.
I'm not assuming that. I'm assuming there's going to be a fair amount of pain in here, and I also assume they're going to make some mistakes.
I would think that what you do...
Musk has already said something dumb with respect to the F-35.
Yeah, I mean, I think these guys... But I think this Rush, whatever, like Rush Swami, I think he's a pretty bright guy. I mean, it wouldn't take... Lou, if you and I got that job, the first thing we would do, if it was me anyway, my suggestion would be, hey, give me the Simpson Bowles report, will you? I'll bet it's still good, right?
I would think it is. Yeah, that's where I would start. But if you read Ramaswamy's book, which I read, he wrote it in advance of his presidential bid about woke culture and. If you read that book, you find out that not only is woke culture a disaster in terms of the impact on your business culture, it's a disaster because it sucks up a ton of money.
Oh, plus you have some people that don't feel like they don't have to do any work and you can't touch them, which is not good.
Well, there's no doubt that it's at least 40% of the federal executive branch.
I wouldn't be a bit, Anyway, Luke, thank you very much. Have you skied yet?
No, we'll try to get up there sometime in probably February when things calm down.
All right,
This is a terrible time to go up there right now.
All right, well, anyway, enjoy yourself. Talk at you next week. SP Futures down 2, Nasdaq Futures down 8. We're going to go a real quick break. Be back, Mr. Dan Janitas.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 2, Nasdaq Futures down 10. I don't think we're going to stay there. I mean, hey, Tesla's up another 250 today. If he stays at Mar-a-Lago for the rest of his life, is the stock going to be like 5,000? Greg, what do you think?
Game on.
Just saying. We have
game on.
I hear let's Professor Dan. Dan, how are you? We're taking care of business, and all of a sudden, here's Dan Janitas, who's always taking. Hey, I missed you last week on Thanksgiving, bud.
Absolutely. I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving.
We did. Did you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Very nice. I am. I have just completed the NobleCon conference here in Boca Raton, Florida, and it's been a good opportunity to talk to a lot of the CEOs and CFOs of companies across a lot of different industries. And as I've mentioned before, it's really where my best source of information. You know, we can read all the articles and people watch YouTube videos to get the perspectives on the economy, but these are the guys that are at it every single day, that are seeing all the trends, that can I think give the clearest picture of what's truly going on. So been a very productive conference. What I've come out with, I think, sort of is some of the conclusions is just that this past year has not been as strong as the market may have suggested in terms of some of the growth we've seen in certain industries, for sure. Energies like media, and retail have really not had great years. There's a little more, positive development coming in the next year, but there really isn't the crazy, I didn't get the sense that we're going to be coming into some nirvana as the stock market's performance would lead you to believe the last few weeks. So the bottom line is that things are moving along fine. There's no major concerns that I'm hearing from companies, but it isn't quite the exuberance. It's not mirroring the exuberance of the stock market. So that's where I come out with this. The other thing I'll say about being in this part of Florida, Southwest Florida, is really not seeing a whole lot of talk, or whether it be one-on-one talk with your buddies or talk with people at the conference or talking to companies, for example, that really relates to impacts from the election. It's really more talk about what's currently going on, some of the different issues that Florida is dealing with, like rebuilding a lot of the housing here because a lot of condo buildings are having to go through major rehabs since that building collapsed back in Sunny Isles a few years back. So there's there are different issues that people are talking about than the election. It isn't really as focused as the national media may be letting people think, and that's kind of good if you're really trying to get a sense of where the values are. And also, I think for some people, it's probably given, you know, taken a little bit of the, stolen a little of their thunder, in the sense that we're not suddenly coming into this exuberant time. I mean, we've been in a very good market environment. We've had a very good year, but it isn't quite as exciting as the stock market would led you to believe.
Well, there's believe. I mean, I have a. Actually, I was going to ask you because at Thanksgiving, I heard one of my my brother's wife has a friend that had a condo down there. This one I was telling you about a long time ago already. The hurricane, not this last year, but like 2 or 3 years ago, was that one, the first one hit on that side, the one that whacked you.
Yeah, that was on the West Coast. That was really bad. And then this past year, there were a couple others that hit this past year, and really depending on where you were, there was less damage, but there was still a fair amount of flooding, and they were fairly severe hurricanes. But it's really the West Coast that got hit over the past.
But there, I think I'm going to say, I'll pick a number, 12 story. Condos, her place was on the 9th floor or something. They still haven't determined whether they're going to try and fix the place or tear it down. She hasn't gotten a time.
Yep. That's a trend here, and that's a trend throughout the state because of what happened a few years ago with the collapse of the building. Collapse of that building wasn't so much related to a hurricane as it was to just code, not being up to code. And a lot of the condo buildings in Florida, the associations have passed on letting doing the additional work that's necessary to bring things up to code because they can't afford it, and because a lot of the residents who aren't fixed incomes don't want to be paying these assessments. Well, guess what? Now they're having to pay the assessments, and a lot of people are being forced out for that reason. But everywhere you look, you see high-rise buildings under construction. You know, you see replacing balconies, painting, upgrading. All that is being required by the state code, and that is a trend that is really changing the demographic of South Florida.
Well, where's everybody going? I mean, actually, a lot of
people are going back north. There's always people they call the halfbacks that go to places like the Carolinas, which are more affordable. A lot of people go back to be with their grandkids. Or their children that can help take care of them as they get older. A lot of people just frankly don't have a choice, so they're trying to manage the best that they can. They're moving in with family that has moved here, so a lot of the kids have been able to move down here during the remote work movement, and so that there's some of that going on, but mostly moving back up north.
Well, regarding the insurance, are people just, if the place used to be worth, $3.25, is somebody just saying, hey, I'll take it off your hands for $110, I just won't buy any insurance?
That is exactly what's happening. People are less confident that the insurance is even going to cover. It's a very common issue here right now, but the big thing is the assessment. You know, that's the, you know, having these major $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 assessments on condo buildings, and it's just it's out of the budget of a lot of people on fixed income.
Well,
so
typically, I mean, boy, that's a bad word. If you have one of these places, and you don't think a hurricane's coming right up your nose, but it might. There's my I won't say former friend because she died last year. She was on the show a bunch. She was involved in a couple of condo things, and some places have the ability or the attitude of you have a pretty good size egg sitting there in case something ever happens. Other places, there's like none. And then if you got a shovel of snow, it's a special assessment. What is there a typical Florida attitude? I can't believe I'm asking a stupid question. Are all of them different, or are they all? Is there a number that says, hey, look, we need a 30% of the yearly investments we need in the bank, or 40 or 50. Is there a standard or whatever?
There has been a standard, but it hasn't been enforced, and now it's being enforced. So that's the difference. So for a state, if Lou was still on, he could validate this, that in Colorado, for example, you are required, you know, the state does have very strict codes on condo buildings in terms of having reserves, in terms of keeping the HOA fees or those monthly condo fees down or keeping them within a certain range, having a certain amount of money allocated for certain types of natural disasters or certain maintenance, or just keeping the buildings up to code. So there are states that, like Colorado, that are stricter than states like Florida. Florida has been behind in that, and now they're coming up to, you know, they're putting more attention on that. So to answer your question, yes, they exist. They have not been enforced, and now they're being enforced.
Well, but is there, what is the standard? You got a half a year's assessment in the thing, or a full year?
That's where they have the flexibility between buildings, and so what some of them are doing is they're just raising the monthly fee, and they're all raising the monthly fee because the insurance is going up. But some of them are raising the monthly fee. Some of them are putting on additional assessments. I know certain states, actually, some of that comes through your taxes, depending on whether you're in a single family home or whether you're in a high rise. But if you're in a high rise condo, you share the building, you share the elevator, you share the grounds with the other people, and that's, it's generally going to be an assessment, a special assessment that's charged.
Were you listening to the last part of the segment with Lou, where I was trying to give, sort of in a half-ass way, some sort of an economics lesson that when you cheer something like, Rush Swami came on yesterday and talked about the overhead charges at these research institutions, you know, hospitals and universities, yes, and so forth, and how it's ridiculously high. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt. I think it's too high. I mean, we had a young, as I mentioned before, we had a young lady on the show talk about the overhead rates they put on money that maybe you and I even donate to the place is kind of absurd, almost to the point where you would wonder if we had the scratch-o, that would we almost want to put up an independent research facility that wasn't really affiliated, just to allow people to do their research work and charge them less than the university. I mean, in an economic, in a perfect world, in a competitive world, that's essentially what would happen. You know, somebody like you and me or somebody, or Lou, and we'd get three people together, we'd pony up, you know, some dough, we'd borrow some money, we'd build a place, and we'd have five or six research places say, hey, you guys are only charging 30% overhead, where the guys over at Northwestern are charging 70, we'll power in by you. Now, whether we need, you know, I don't know, we need sinks and test tubes, or what else you need for this kind of stuff, I wouldn't be the guy to ask, but this world isn't competitive, because those guys are getting the stuff, and we wouldn't be. But now,
yeah, I mean, that is happening. I mean, and that's what we talk about, the biotech firms, for example, in Boston, that are doing, a lot of them are doing single product, single products. But if the R&D, if you will, is being paid for, the clinical tests are being paid for generally by grants, donations. In some cases, there are private equity firms that have stepped in because they believe strongly in whatever the drug is, or whatever the, you know, devices, or whatever the, you know, the product is that they're doing research on. So a lot of that money is being funded by these grants, by these private equity firms, and that will probably continue outside of the larger organizations that have always had to have a percentage allocated for R&D. In fact, that's a good point, Chief, because in the discussions with some of the CEOs the past few days, the management teams, we talk about how they're spending capital. The main theme that I got, when I asked about R&D and all that, there was more of a sense of cutback, more of a sense of, we're not necessarily adding to those areas. We're not looking at CapEx, increasing CapEx. What we're looking at doing, and what we have been doing, is buying back shares. So that has been a common theme across probably five or six of the companies I spoke to. A lot more using capital to enhance shareholder value by buying back shares, in some cases by increasing dividends, as opposed to
What does anybody, Dan, think that anybody increases shareholder value by buying back shares?
It depends on the company. It depends on the float. It depends on the it really depends on the perspective of the investor. But that's, yeah, I mean, oftentimes that's the way management views it, that they're it's favorable to the.
Well, what if someday I met a, they had some couple of guys, and I might say, in my opinion, you know, just guys obviously don't Meta stock that are going crazy. They love the fact that Zuckerberg's been down in Mar-a-Lago for 5 days and the thing's going up every day. They're talking about what a great company is because they're buying their stock back. Then someday, somewhere, and I hope it doesn't happen, Meta stock is not going to be 614. Maybe someday it'll be 200. Now, I know that's blasphemy because all we do is keep up, and Trumpy we trusty. But what if it is? Are you be really happy with your board that they bought all that stock at 614 when it's trading 200?
Yeah, I wouldn't be. Yeah, no, I mean, I think more the way you do, Chief. I'm kind of saying it more when I mention this. I'm not necessarily supporting what they're doing. I'm just sort of reporting what I'm hearing from them. I'm not necessarily saying that's the best use of capital is to buy back stock. It's relatively, you know, they're looking at opportunities where there may have been a sell-off, a short-term sell-off, and it may look relatively cheap. But you're right. If you look over a period of time, that's still that stock is still very expensive, and it's a sign of confidence in the business. I think when management buys back stock, it's a sign of you would hope if you trust them that they're doing it at the right time. But you're right, there could be an entire sell-off in the market or a sell-off in a sector or a certain area of the market that now makes that stock trade.
I think the only reason why people buy back stock is because of the difference in the tax laws. Well, two reasons. One of the people on the board and the upper management have stock options.
Right.
And, which is a wrong idea to be doing something like that, I think. But I guess the economic lessons here, I'm just kind of stunned, Dan. I would have thought by now, since people spend a fortune to go to school, that most people would have a clue on economics and just kind of the stuff you're being told. I mean, I don't have a problem, by the way, of the government. Matter of fact, I think it's well overdue because it's pushed some places to be dramatically bigger than they ought to be, being some of these massive hospital university complexes that, you know, the only reason why they're there is from other people's largesse. But in one man's opinion. But the idea, I just wish that most people, I mean, that's why I hope a lot of people listen to the show, when you go giddy over, they just had it on CNBC, passed by in a headline, that they're going to cut back on all these stuff they're given to, you know, what Washington is going to do. But I would hope that most people, at least the people listening to the show, are smart enough to realize that if you cut the overhead rate that Northwestern can charge, which I think is an outrageous number, by the way, from 70 down to 30, your fat ass might be the one getting fired. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, it's there's. I mean, the economy money is like silly putty. You pull it out of one place or squeeze it here, it pops out somewhere else, right? So if we're gonna squeeze these places on these grants, those are the people that Kyle reports, and we'll report again tomorrow. That's where all the jobs are going. So right. I mean, don't be surprised if Northwestern lays off 500 people. Now, you know, you could be like Lou said, oh, those are people that shouldn't be there anywhere. They're the DEI people. It won't be all DEI people. No way. It'll be all kinds of people, right? So, I mean, what we're going to see is the federal government has had this huge largesse towards all these institutions recently, towards local municipalities and towards states. They've poured the money out, and now their balance sheet looks like crap, basically, right? And so all of a sudden we're going to turn it back the other way. Okay, but don't think there's not going to be a side effect all along. Everything you do, you has an effect to it, right?
Yeah, it's the rate of pace of the change that makes the difference. And that basically to me is really the difference with this administration, is that it may be, or at least the talk is out there that's going to happen very quickly. We were, you know, again, another question that I asked all the management, and that I think is very a very current topic, is, you know, this whole shift in, with employment numbers coming out today, actually, that this sort of shift in what has happened with employment and in general across the board. It was tough a few years ago to find anybody to work, and I noticed that even you were, as part of your discussion with Lou, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's people are, you know, people could go anywhere and they could chart, they could name their price and all that. It was hard to get good talent. And then now sort of the shift of cutting staff and going more towards automation and getting rid of some of the excess, you're going to lose, you're right, you're going to lose some good people. You're also going to lose a culture. There's going to be morale issues in the organizations when that happens, especially if it happens too quickly. And now that, but we're actually literally in the midst of that. 2024 has been a year of the transition in the labor market, going from the working remotely to having to be back in the office. A question that I asked every senior manager that I met with. It's a challenge for the companies because the people, some of the good talent did, you know, were younger people that did relocate, you know, an hour or two from the city, and you know, it just makes it more difficult to come back in, if you, especially if you have a service related job as opposed to a job where you have to be.
Yeah, but Dan, you would never have recommended to your son or daughter, given the COVID, given this idea everybody's working from, you would never have recommended to them to move so far away from work they can't go back. No, nobody would have been that dumb. But people did.
Yeah. You know, and that's part of it. They did, and then they also got used to a work schedule that wasn't that, even if they did have stay close by, they got used to a work schedule where they weren't in the office every day. They had these additional benefits, they were getting paid huge sums of money. And now we're kind of dealing with at least talk of the opposite happening, especially with the sort of the Musk mentality of, and the Trump mentality of just sort of terminating, you know, people for the sake of terminating people. And it's, you know, the good managers are going to go in and look at where the excess is and get, you know, lighten up in those areas. And that is generally a good sign. And getting back to this equilibrium, we talk about what Powell was looking for, what he's been saying for the last several years is we want to see price stability, but we also want to see full employment. And that's the place where, you know, that it, where it's shouldn't be that hard to hire good talent, but at the same time, it shouldn't be that hard to, well, it shouldn't be that hard to find good talent, but there should be enough talent out there. You know, there should be people that are looking for jobs and moving between jobs. And some of that is starting
depending,
to happen.
Depending on the industry, you're scaling or
isn't. It's industry dependent. It's, you know, specific industries where, you know, the workers have to be on the ground. I mean, they have to be there regardless of what. COVID may not have impacted some industries or may have impacted some more than others. But I think businesses like business services, consulting, any type of service related industry, and that's a big part of our economy, having to deal with these changes in the employment world, and they're being exacerbated by some of the discussion, at least, of further cuts. And, you know, I don't disagree that there are probably positions that were created that need to be eliminated. I would say you want to repurpose that talent. You know, hopefully you can find places for those people, you know, that might be more productive. But there's definitely, we are in that transition. That's a very, I think it's a very current, you know, it's a current topic. It's we're literally in the midst of it in 24. It's going to be interesting to see what happens to labor in 25.
Well, the idea, and I was mentioning earlier, I did, you know, one of the problems I have with the election, and by the way, it was genius to do it. I mean, obviously the other side had no clue, is you, this constant, when you see people are hurt, and you and I have talked for as long as you've been on the show, how the economy has not reached the growth that everybody talks about all day long, has not reached 80 or 85% of the people.
Right.
And so those people, like every other human being, they want to know it's not their fault. They want to know it's somebody else's fault. They want to have blame being placed on somebody. You know, if it wasn't the migrants, it was something. And it was, you know, that somehow you've done everything right, which most people have. It just hasn't worked out for you. Now, so, but I look at this guy, Paul, and I, you know, the man's supposed to be, he seems like a generally terrific guy. I mean, I don't, on a personal level, I have no issues with him, but the dude has, in the 6 years he's been in there, he talks about this inflation, he talks about supply chain, this, and all this bull crap. The dude has increased the money supply in the 6 years he's been there 52%.
Right.
What do you think the growth has been in the 6 years? If it's 2% a year, we're talking about 40% inflation in 6 years, which is exactly what we have.
Right.
I mean, it's right there in front of the dude. Yet you can't even ask that question if he's in the room. I mean, it's so damn obvious to me. What am I missing here?
I think you've hit it on the head, Chief, for the last 5 years. You know, we've been talking about the consequences of increased money supply that's come from a number of sources. You know, originally from the major cut in corporate taxes, the money that was put in during COVID, the money that is continued to be put into the system by the Fed that has sort of taken a back burner and has not been really well. Hasn't been discussed or, you know, as much as it should be. And then people are asking the question, why are we still seeing higher food prices? Why, you know, if we're seeing at the top level that inflation has really come down, why don't I see that at the grocery store? Why don't I see that when I, you know, having my some work done on my house and the contractor is charging me that, or I have to get we're getting wills and estates done and my attorney's charging me triple what they charged last year. So there are services and there are goods that are still clearly inflated. The rate of increase in price may not be there, but they're still inflated.
Well, it's starting to kick up. And hey, we gotta dash off the break here, Dan. S&P futures down 1, NASDAQ futures down 6. I'm going to say those won't last. We'll be up. How's that for a prediction, Dan? We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right
now. Lord Rumpick, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 1, NASDAQ Futures down 6. A little bit of a pause here. We got records all over the place yesterday, so it's been a great year to be long stocks. I mean, I know my clients are happy. We even had, you know, some of the stuff that, hadn't moved in a while. We had a lot of people in the Russell, which really was lagging. But now all of a sudden, the last few months, most people have kind of caught up. So, yes, you know, pretty much everybody's happy if you're in. But boy, you're really happy if you got Bitcoin. It went over 100,000 for the first time yesterday. But we'll get to that in a second. The DAX up 60.3%. FTSE down 11.1%. CAC around up 1. Call that unchanged. So not much going on over in Europe. I guess you could say they're up a little bit. Nikkei up 119.3%, trying to get to this 40,000, 39,395. Hang Seng down 182, that's a full 1%, 19,560. I thought those guys might hit 20,000 today, but they have to wait a little longer. Shanghai up 4, 33,68. Yesterday, we got a new record. Dow over 45,000, it was up 308. S&P up 36, and NASDAQ up 254, so kind of a pretty serious day, especially for the big seven. They've been going crazy as these guys have been going down to Mar-a-Lago, whether people are thinking they're getting a promise of no antitrust or whatever people are thinking, but they love it, the fact that they're seemingly making peace with the new administration. Bonds, 10-year up 3 basis points, 4.21. The Bund up 2 basis points, 2.08. Japan up 2 basis points, 1.07. Oil, again, these guys are under 70 bucks, 68.53, down a penny. Brent down 2 cents, 72.29. So the huge oil rally is just not happening, at least not yet. Natural gas up 7 cents, 211. RBOB unchanged, 193. Gold down 5 bucks. We had a little bit of a rally yesterday, but it's hanging in here, 26.71, so in the high mid-2600s. Silver down 15 cents, 31.65. Copper down a penny, 4.19. We have foreign exchange. The pound is back over 105, the 105.5, but still a lot lower than a few weeks ago. I mean, not pound, the euro. I do that every day. The British pound unchanged at 127. Actually, it was a little stronger. It's back over 127. So the dollar has gotten a little bit of a weaker. The British pound's been the one that's been the strongest. Crypto, up $4,300, 103,252 for Bitcoin. Wow. I'm not so sure. Evidently, Trump's going to back Bitcoin. At least that's the rumor. I don't know what that even means. Some guy today was already talking about 200,000. Why not 500,000? What the hell? Greg, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports, the Hawks.
Good morning, everyone.
Where were the people last night going to see the Hawks? What are they doing?
7:35 here in Chicago. We have windy and cold weather. Be sure to wear layers. It says in AccuWeather. Feels like 12 with a high of 29 today. Phoenix, 51 degrees right now. Mostly sunny. Very warm. A high of 80 today. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 51 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 67 minutes. Inbound Ike from Wolf, 42 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 26 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 43 minutes. Sports, Bruins beat the Hawks. That was here at UC. That was 4-2. And NFL tonight, we have Packers at Lions. Detroit favored by 3.5. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Detroit's got a bunch of people hurt on defense. And Green Bay seemed to get a little better. The quarterback's good, I think.
They're still favoring. I mean, that this is... The home advantage is usually 3, so they got 3. They're given 3.5. I mean, they're the better
team. Detroit's a lot better team normally, but how many guys... They had like 9 starters out on defense by the time the Bear game was over. It's huge.
They're in a different league than the Bears. So.
Oh, yeah. How many people from the Bears do you think start for the Lions? I'd say a couple of guys on defense, maybe.
Definitely not Williams.
No.
Yeah.
No. But Jaylen, I think a couple Johnson, of the safety's pretty good. The one cornerback is really good, right?
Yeah. Other than that, I think
nobody on offense.
You'd be a Shingo. You know what a Shingo is?
No.
Remember Shingo Takatsu?
Yeah.
Yeah, the closer on the white side. Yeah. He was Mr. Zero.
Yeah, Mr. Zero. Yeah.
Mr. You get a Shingo.
The Dan, what is I didn't ask you this. It's a little off the stuff, but it's when you predict things going forward, like, you know, you and I are, you know, we're predicting the market every day, and we're you know, protecting stuff, looking for the good bonds, and we sense this somewhat separation. I mean, you sense it more than me because you're actually going to see mid-level managers and so forth. And the money is free view of the top 50 firms isn't exactly the same view you get these other guys. You get more of a balanced kind of view, I think. But going forward, what would you, the incredible euphoria you hear about day by day on the news stations with the stock market going up every day doesn't match what you and I see in the everyday world. I mean, it's not like everyday world is horrible. It's not. I mean, it's way better than COVID, and it's, you know, probably getting better by the day. But if you were to do a, you know, some sort of a, if you're going to price like ESPN's money they're going to spend for football or baseball, or you're going to sign a, you know, a baseball guy for 10 or 15 years, what kind of prediction model, what do you think the world's going to look like 10 years from now, or in terms of, you know, are outfielders going to be making $40 million or are you making $4 million? You think, you know, if I pay $3 billion for the rights at the NFL, I'm going to be a genius, or all of a sudden nobody's going to watch 4-hour games with commercials and nobody's going to pay for it to come in? What would you predict if it was you? I know I'm hitting you up with this one out of the blue, but I often wonder. I was trying to talk to, Kevin is pretty good, a couple of weeks ago on this, and we were trying to talk about what would your view be before you signed, you know, a player for $15 million a year for 8 years right now. What do you think 8 years out is going to be? Is 15 going to be a bargain, or are you going to be overpaying, or how do you?
Yeah, well, if you base it on history, you know, and if you base it on the sort of momentum, the it's going to be much higher. You know, if you're looking forward and making predictions based on what we see in business, you know, not so much what may relate specifically to a contract with a new you know, with some new talent or new athlete, for there's you know, you'd likely probably see it on the high end because that's the trend, and that has been the trend, and it is like a snowball effect, and you want to make sure that you lock in the best rate that you can in this environment, because it only looks like things are going to go higher and they're going to get more expensive, and you know, the cost, medical costs, and, you know, a lot of the other costs that we're talking about, other service costs, You know, at some point, you know, the cost of advertising goes up, the cost of, you know, all the, you know, running the, you know, running the organizations goes up. So there's, I would say if they were going to air, it's going to have to be on the high end. It's unlikely that they're going to be able to settle for something that's, you know, that status quo, or that would be based on an inflation rate of like 2%, because even though, accordingly, inflation has come down to 2%, I think it's likely that we, you know, in the short run, I would be trying to get as much as I could right now going forward, and that you're going to have a lot of support, and you're going to have a lot of data that would back that.
Well, I think we both sense a kind of maybe not necessarily different directions, but a different pace of the top 5% versus the rest of us. How long, in your opinion, is that? It's probably been happening now really since 2000 somewhat, but really since 2008, when some people really got helped out of the mess. And then you had all kinds, for a long period of time, people with savings only made 1%, which I think really cut them back. When you had some people being able to borrow under the inflation rate, which really put some people ahead of other people. But is it a 20-year phenomenon? It's always going to be like we're going back to the serfs and the nobles, or are we going to have something like 1921-9? It's a great equalizer again. I mean, I wish I could predict it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think just because of our history, we know that there has to be some sort of stabilizer out there. There gets to a point, you know, if we're using the sports analogy, that you know, how much can you charge for a ticket for a game or a season ticket? How much can you charge for a hot dog? How much, you know, there's a certain price point where it becomes ridiculous, and I think in some cases it's already there, as far as I'm concerned. It really depends on your level of support and loyalty for your team, how it happens, I'm not exactly sure. Something tells me it's not going to be a soft from here on in. It's not going to necessarily be a continued soft landing. There's going to be some more severe bumps, based on the fact that some of these, at least some of the discussion of things like tariffs and some discussion of some of the cuts that we're hearing could have a more substantial impact on the market. It's just the interesting thing, Chief, and I started out saying this, is it's just like the market is barreling forward and sort of ignoring everything that's happening on the side. And, you know, to have all of these managers saying, you know, things are okay, you know, our businesses are doing fine, but, you know, we have these concerns and things certainly aren't going as crazy as the markets are saying. So there has to be a point, and this is why we've stayed on the sidelines to a certain degree with stocks. When the market is breaking a new high for the 57th time this year, that you have to say, okay, at what point is this going to stop and turn around, or is this going to correct? And it's generally the way it's been lately. It's only been a day or two, and then we're right back to these, we're right back to that same momentum. Some of it, I think, is self-fulfilling. You know, people just putting more money in. You know, the stats on things like travel and, you know, the retail sales stats are not consistent with the way the market is going either. You know, so there's this momentum, I think, is just sort of a craze. I have a friend who recently got into crypto, who is a sports coach, and not at all his thing, and it was quite surprising to me. And I'm happy for him that he's moved into this area. I don't know whether I would have recommended if he had come to me and asked whether that should be an area that he put all of his money in and start a business in. But you know, when you see those types of shifts, you have to wonder if there's, you know, the, you know, a lot more that is based, a lot more of people's decisions are based on just sort of not missing out and just being part of something that is on this roll, is, you know, not wanting to miss out of that. That all being said, I would say about fixed income, this has been a really good year for bonds. If you're on the high yield side of things, which we are, you know, returns are close to 9%. I know that sounds boring compared to 25, but it's not bad. If you look on a risk-adjusted basis, it's very attractive. rates are continuing to come down. Even short rates will come down on the 18th. We're going to see probably another 25 basis point high cut. So the trend is for lower rates on shorter bonds, means short-term bonds are still good investments. As the stock market does well, corporate bonds do even better because they're higher in the capital structure. So we're getting 6 or 7% on some corporate bonds. We still like corporates short-term, inside of 2 years. Very attractive yields for the amount of risk you take. And, you know, the spreads are tight, but there's, you know, but that's a pretty, you know, on a risk-adjusted basis, things look good. And I don't want to be holding the, you know, 90% of my retirement money and a few tech stocks when the correction comes.
Well, I wonder, Dan, I mean, you and I keep looking at this stuff and say, well, gee, the P.E. ratios and stuff are pretty darn high. I have a Meta with over 10 times revenue, you know, which is for a stock that big is like really a lot. I think it's like 28 times earnings. But which is for stocks that are growing, either these things are ridiculously expensive, but they don't ever seem to want to come down. So maybe, or they're just going to carve up more and more. But I think you reach the point where you can't get more blood out of the turnip being the everyday American. I mean, and I'm wondering if to me, just my economic knowledge, which is in fixed income and stuff, I mean, you just said it, interest rates are coming down. Well, how the hell, Dan, on a world view, when everybody keeps borrowing more and more and more, how do interest rates go down and down?
I mean, yeah, it doesn't usually go that way.
Doesn't usually go that way, does it?
No, and that's why I think the yield curve, you know, looking at where the yield is based on maturities, you know, for, you know, short term, you know, or longer term, that's why the yield curve has not performed, or not. We haven't been able to look at it and make predictions as we have in the past. So when the yield curve is inverted, meaning you get more higher yields on your short-term bonds than you do on your long-term bonds, it generally means a slowdown in the economy is coming. Well, in a sense, we can't really say that we've seen this. We have seen somewhat of a slowdown, but not any significant slowdown. And now that the yield curve is steepening, that generally means more of a pickup in the economy. And that, you know, that's kind of hard to imagine as well, that we're going to see any major pickup in the economy. So we may just be at a place, the yield curve might be just telling us right now that we're at a place that's not too bad and that we shouldn't, you know, we're getting some decent yield, rates are coming down. Don't buy long bonds because there is volatility there. But you can still get some decent yield if you stay, you know, inside of 5 years. Under 5 years in corporates and in treasuries, T-bills, still look attractive. So if you want to stay on the sidelines, it's not a bad place to be and still, you know, watch your assets grow.
Well, the VIX is not low, but it's certainly way lower than it's been. We've had once in a while, didn't used to have to do this, Dan. When we first started our protective index program in 1997, there was only one ETF, was the SPY, the S&P 500, and then came the QQQ a few years after that. So we were able to actually manage a real serious track record, where we were Money Manager of the Year in 1997 with who are the guys who do the Money Manager of the Year? Tells the name of the rating service,
Morningstar.
Because the idea was we were protected, we didn't go down, and the VIX was low enough where you could actually buy extra puts. But it was, and all of a sudden now that thing is sort of turned to where, you know, you're protected. But even now, now there's all these different ETFs, right? So a lot of people, we have all kinds of people in the XLV. Which is the healthcare piece, which has performed actually well, but it hasn't performed the same as if you were in the top seven stocks. Right. You know, and we have a lot of people. We used to have people in the XLE, the oil piece. None of them really wanted that. But you're almost, when people send you money, which they do a lot, we you know, we have to pick an ETF, which, you know, it's almost like picking stocks damn near, which is what I didn't want to do in the first place. But in about 3-4 months ago, maybe 6 months ago, we got a lot of money came in, and we put it, the Russell had been lagging so much that we put almost all of it in the Russell. And we, you know, we bought some puts a little further out of the money than normally because these people were a little bullish and they weren't retired, you know, so we didn't have to protect them as much. That's why it's so hard to spout track records, because everybody is so different. You know, if they're retired, you got to make sure they're tightened up like a drum. If they're not, you let it be a lot longer. I mean, you know, we could say retired people we have is 50 delta, and the people still working are 25 or 30 delta protections, which means they're 50 long or 75 long. But we've gotten the Russell, and all of a sudden for the last 3 months, we've caught up dramatically. I mean, the Russell has really outperformed. I think we've done way better than if we'd have been the S&P. And not so much. I think we probably equaled the Qs, maybe. But all these other ones, like the XLE, the XLV, we did a lot better than that. For a 3 or 4 month period. Now, next 3 or 4 months, you know, who knows? The Russell may go back the other way again. But it's the market is volatile, not even with the stocks, but it's volatile between the pieces in the market, which is kind of odd.
There has definitely been, you know, sector rotation. There's been, you know, I think what's happened as the magnificent seven tech stocks have run, then there's, you know, the obvious advantage that those companies are going to do well as the market says, then there's a whole slew of other companies behind them that are going to benefit from that as well. So people are looking down, you know, looking through other industries, and then they're also looking down the market cap spectrum at smaller companies that could benefit in this environment. The other sort of common theme that I heard at the conference was a number of companies, smaller companies who I met with, talking about the chance of being bought out. So there's still M&A activity going on, and that fuels the market, and that will fuel the market into 2025. There's still a lot of private equity firms and private credit firms that are chomping at the bit for good ideas. That will continue to fuel the market. There's a fair amount of money there. And even in the area, you know, distressed area, which is an area that I've have expertise in from the past, there aren't a lot of opportunities. So it's very likely that a lot of the companies that have had issues are going to be bought up by, either private equity or private credit, or, at least a piece of their business is going to be spun out to a larger organization that can better manage them. So the environment is positive in that regard, and it's spreading it out over the, as you mentioned, the sectors in the market, and also the market caps, you know, the smaller companies being able to benefit as well.
Dan, how much of, if any, we've talked on several times and, you know, on different occasions about, in my opinion, and I think you agreed, that the idea of letting these huge firms being able to borrow way under the inflation rate, that's what makes ball teams go way up and other things. When you go to a place and you talk about some good management, yet they're still going to pay, as some of the bonds you recommend, 6, 6.5, you know, 5.5, whatever it is, because you talk about those firms all the time. Are the people buying them able to borrow at like 2 or 3? Is that the advantage that they're getting by taking these people over, or what? Is it a rate advantage, or is that not part of the factor?
Right now there's a rate advantage because they are able to borrow at lower rates. Those would be the higher quality companies, so they're able to make those purchases. The other thing with companies that have debt that are paying like 6% or higher, they're refinancing right now. So, and that's been a home run for us. We've had a lot of corporate bonds that have the ability to get called back, and they're refinancing at lower rates. So as rates are coming down, that's another positive. That's another factor that isn't really discussed or considered, but it's you got a nice pop in the price of your bond at that point. Some of my clients will ask, well, what about the fact that the rates have come down? Are we getting paid as much? And I said, as long as the trend is down for rates, it's positive all the way around, because you're making money as a bondholder. It's definitely helping your balance sheet look better. So if you own the stock, or if you're looking at the stock, that's a positive as well. So that's why we're kind of in the best of all worlds when you look at it from the point of view of investing, but when you look at it from the point of view, as we've discussed, from overall leverage, you know, the especially going down to the household level, realizing that there's a lot more debt there, looking at the federal deficit, looking at ways of controlling that, things aren't looking as good. And the two are not in sync right now. The market is saying one thing for how companies are performing, and then the actual economy is facing some other challenges that have just been overlooked during this election year, and I think are going to come to fruition in 2025.
Well, I was when things started to get concentrated over the last 40 years, really, that I've been watching stuff. You have your even your Home Depot. So your Amazon did an amazing job doing that because a lot of it was because they weren't paying taxes for a while. But I mean, Walmart obviously has a big footprint. And I think for a long period of time, Dan, there was kind of enough competition around, and there still is online. I mean, Walmart's made a big chunk out of Amazon, I think, lately. But I didn't think for a while these people even recognized how much power they had. I mean, how much Home Depot really could go in on any given Saturday and raise all the prices 6%, especially if they stayed away from the headline items and still had the cheaters in the aisle that looked like they were cheap. They could run around and raise up prices on like nails and glue and all the other crap that people buy.
Yeah.
They could raise that 10%, nobody would even notice. And I think somewhere along the line, these guys have all figured out the power they have. To where I'm not so, Microsoft, we were talking about, everybody has some Microsoft stuff they use. I mean, how many people, my brother obviously, and we, other people here in the office, you can't buy any software from those guys anymore. You got to rent it.
Right.
And how many people, all of a sudden, if you have, even Windows, what's the financial thing? I had it at home. I'm like, what do I need it home for? I got it at work. I stopped paying. I was paying them, $20 a month for stuff that you used to be able to buy for $40 and you owned it.
That's a really good point. I think there's, it happens if you think of it like from the big box store point of view, right? And then also like you can translate that. I mean, you can like take that and look at other expenses that say the individual has. For example, your utility bill is going up exponentially. It's going up a little bit at a time. You say, another $20, that's no big deal. But then, that'll continue to happen. And then you see it in other areas, that you're not, you're not expecting, it's only a little bit more. You say, it's only a little bit more. But that little bit more adds up, and that is how these companies are making money. And there has been some pushback from people saying, grocery stores, for example, should not be this profitable. They haven't been this profitable for years because they've had razor thin margins. The benefit of being able to buy, have use Amazon and have something delivered to your house. You're saving money there. If you're a consumer, you're thinking you're saving money there, but after time, if you really look carefully, you pay more. And one of the areas that you mentioned, Chief, too, which I did talk to a media company that gave me some terrific insight, are the expenses that you're paying for additional, to stream a show or to add another network where you don't have to watch commercials to see a game without commercials or to see a movie without commercials. You're paying more for all these services, and you're saying, another $9, another $10. But then you look at your bill at the end of the month, and it actually does add up. And these are ways that these other costs have been crept in there, costs from the point of view of the consumer. But it's been a way that companies have been able to add some extra revenue where they're maybe losing it, some of it, or losing some market share. They're making it up and increasing costs on these other services that people are just sort of overlooking. Some of the people, frankly, are overlooking it because they're making all the money. They're watching their stocks go up and they're saying, hey, and I can say that myself, that, I'm paying a little more for that Amazon service, or I'm paying a little more for Netflix or whatever. But I made it up over here. So people aren't saying much. At some point, there has to be pushback from the consumer. And I don't know what that point is. At some point, that ticket to that ball game is going to be at a price where the person says, hey, I'm just going to watch it at home.
Well, we got a dash, Dan, but I just got the thing yesterday. I got the thing from one of my buddies. The game at Notre Dame, the first playoff game, now we're talking December in South Bend, and it might even be a night game, for God's sake. The one Saturday night last week was 4 hours. So you're going to put your fanny over in a seat and in there.
It's a long game.
For the good seats are $250 a throw. So, okay, if I'm going to bring, you know, Audrey and maybe a couple other people, it's a G. Now, if I want a decent parking place, I got to pay up for that. That's going to be $400.
Yep.
If I don't want to walk from God knows where in the middle of winter. Now, tolls, gas, everything to get down there, we're talking about a $2,000 night. To sit there for 4 hours as a studio audience while they play commercials. You know, you probably know. I'll ask how many minutes of action are in a college football game?
Right.
You know,
very few.
Right? It's like 11 in a 4 hour time zone.
Right.
And on a hard seat without a back on the seat. I mean, really?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys, I don't think they appreciate it, but I walked into season of my buddies last night, a local place, and all the guys I know are all going to the Hawk game, and they're going, you know, we bought these tickets and blah, 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 and we haven't been there in 3 years, and one guy's bringing his son and so forth. They just want, you know, they just wanted to go to one. I said, how much are they paying you to go? I mean, you know, it's almost at a point where they'd have to pay me to go to one of these things. And right. It's the other way around. Talk at you next week. Missed you last week, our Dan Fix. We'll talk at you next week. And you don't want to be up here today. It's too cold. You're better off in Florida.
Better off here in Florida. Yeah.
Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks. S&P down 2. NASDAQ futures down 12. Have a good day, everybody.
That's all, folks.